www.themouthmagazine.com.
Joining me on this edition of the Mouthcast, I'm delighted to say, is a man whose mellifluous bass playing has enriched many a night in the local dance hall. Sir Horace Gentleman, aka Horace Panter, bass player of the Specials, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thank you very much. Mellifluous, yeah, I like that. Yeah, okay.
Getting angry.
The specials are mid-tour at the moment. We're sitting here in a reasonably well-appointed golf hotel and leisure complex on the edge of the town the band's playing tonight. Just thinking about social conditions in the country at the moment, you must have seen hundreds of towns like this, towns that are down on their knees to some degree.
Yes, it's the way it is, you know, isn't it? Everything's concrete and poundland and, you know, what everyone wants. And yeah, it's difficult touring as well because you don't get to see too much of that, you know. I mean, okay, no, that's rubbish, actually, because I was in Sheffield yesterday and I had a good wander around. But it was full of students, so it wasn't that bad. But yeah, there were a lot of sort of downtrodden-looking people in Sheffield, yeah.
Do you feel parallels today with back then, back in...
I find it extraordinary that the lyrics that were written for 35 years ago are still prescient now. We opened the show with Ghost Town, and it's like, wow, yes, you know, you could really still identify that song to an awful lot of places in England, definitely.
So I was 11 or 12 when that single came out, which is not a traditionally politically aware age, I wouldn't say, but I do remember it feeling like a dramatic statement on the way the country was.
It was extraordinary. There I was sitting in this little flat that I had in Coventry watching the news, and, you know, there's civil unrest in sort of in Brixton, in Liverpool, in, you know, in, all over the place. And the soundtrack was a record that I played on and that was at number one in the charts. It was a very eerie feeling, definitely. Yeah, but it was what life was like back then. We came to prominence just before, we started to come to prominence just before Margaret Thatcher was elected. In fact, we played a gig in London the day before the election. I remember this, and then it all started to happen from then on. Well, actually, there was like the 3-day week and all sorts of stuff before then. Well, it was the oil crisis in 1973, wasn't it? And then a lot of industry closed and whatever. Coventry, where we came from, was you know, this big industrial hub where they made cars and machine tools and all that sort of stuff. And all these factories just gradually disappeared, and now they're new housing developments or retail parks. It's the same all over. It was the same in Birmingham. It was the same in Sheffield, you know, and an awful lot of cities. And people say, oh, Ghost Town was written about Coventry. Actually, it was written about everywhere. Mm. You know, and I think that was the sort of, it applied to an awful lot of places where you lived. Back in the early 80s, definitely.
So it had massive relevance, as you say, to a lot of places, not just Coventry, but it's got massive relevance today. As you mentioned, you look at the high streets of many towns and it's all pound shops and the sort of bigger stores, if you like, of...
And a lot of places are all boarded up, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's difficult. And although lots of money has been thrown at a lot of cities, you know, like Birmingham now, you know, there's the brand new station, there's new shopping complexes. This is the same in Coventry. There's still that undercurrent of the shops round the corner that are all boarded up. Yeah. Don't ask me what the answer is.
No.
I honestly don't know.
Well, it is a question, isn't it? You know, when you look at it, but... The social commentary in the music of the specials, and in fact many other bands also in that wave of the two-tone ska revival at that time, it was and still is an integral part of the music.
Yeah, well, it came from punk rock, which was the voice of disaffected youth. You know, I remember Jerry always saying he thought the music was dreadful, but the lyrics were great. So the Clash especially, I think we owe a great big debt to the Clash, not in just performing styles, but in you know, again, the songs that they wrote about. So we had the sort of the concept of punk, but we sort of dressed it up in sort of Caribbean rhythms and you know, made this thing, this two-tone thing, which meant that you could dance and think at the same time, you know.
Was that arrived at as cynically as that you were dressing up punk in, you know, that you made that conscious decision to put the two things together, or did it happen naturally?
It wasn't cynical. No, it was. There was this thing to make this new British dance music, but the whole sort of ethos of punk about writing what the Jamaicans call conscious lyrics, you know, was very much in, you know, the forefront of what we were trying to do, and did, yeah.
As you say, Thatcher was Prime Minister in the band's commercial heyday, the chart years, let's say. It was an important time to stand up and be counted.
I think a lot of the sort of the policies that Margaret Thatcher put into practice were probably came to fruition, if that's the word, after the band had split up.
Mm.
You know, to say that sort of we were the result of or a reaction against Margaret Thatcher would perhaps not be true. I think we were pretty much fully formed before the Conservatives were elected to power in 1979. You know, but punk started in sort of 75, 76 as a result of Labour governments, or just like the whole sort of like downturn in the world economy, really.
I think it's interesting to note that point, really, because it would be easy to say that all of that came as a result of Conservatives.
Yeah, I always think that the music of the Thatcher era was the sort of the new romantic kind of, you know, frilly shirt, you know, let's forget about the fact that it's grim and let's go and wear frilly shirts and sit in yachts outside Buenos Aires and all that kind of stuff, which is totally devoid of reality, really. I don't like Spandau Ballet. Or Duran Duran, for those specific reasons, I think. Really.
I might say, I'm no Spandau or Duran apologist, but my take on it is that there is a place for that kind of escapism, I think.
Yeah, sure. But it seems a shame, like that, you know, that we'd actually been addressing real issues, and then along comes this sort of Busby Berkeley pop, escapism, you know.
Do you see anyone around these days who can deliver that spark to ignite people's fire in the belly?
There's a few people. There's a girl in London called Millie Manders, who I think is very, very good. I would have liked her to have done some work with us on this tour, but we've got an amazing sounding reggae band instead. She's really good, but I can't think of any others. I don't listen to a lot of contemporary music.
Hmm.
I'm 63. You know what I mean? And you haven't got Top of the Pops anymore, you know? And I've got better things to do than listen to six music, I'm afraid. I'm not proud of the fact, you know, but I spend my time doing other stuff. And I listen to music of the past, really, you know, blues, country music, ska, reggae, you know, stuff from the 50s and 60s, really.
I can think of Sleaford Mods.
Crikey, yes, I forgot about them. Yeah, I was so pleased. That goes against everything that I've just said in the past 5 minutes. No, I was really pleased that we were able to get them to tour with us in 2014. In 1978, we toured with The Clash, and the support band, the official support band on that tour was Suicide from New York, you know, Alan Vega and Marty Rev. Mm. And having Sleaford Mods on tour with the Specials reminded me of Suicide on tour with The Clash. In Glasgow, when they started their show, people were booing, but at the end of their little set, they were applauding.
Mm.
You know, they were really good. Like I say, I think we were very lucky to get them, and they dug the band. You know, they realised, you know, the importance of the stuff that we played 30 odd years ago and its contemporary relevance. Yeah.
Mm. We just mentioned the gloss and the glitz of the 80s, the music of the 80s. Was it difficult not to be seduced by that, particularly as you were part of a successful band functioning within the business, which is a business which has never been shy of wearing its vulgarity on its sleeve?
But we demanded a certain amount of autonomy. We had our own label. We recorded other bands that we chose. But yes, we were, I suppose, whether we liked it or not, we were very much at the behest of a record company saying, all right, we want the second album now, when we hadn't written any tunes for it and all that sort of, which put us under an enormous amount of pressure. Yeah, I mean, it's always that thing, were we a pop group or were we a political force? I think we were essentially a pop group, but we had a message. Mm. You know, kind of like the MC5 were, you know, I think... I love the MC5, but that was that's the only sort of like sort of thing I can think, or the Clash or whatever, who sort of, you know, pretty much wore their hearts on their sleeves, and the different sort of factions within the Specials made it sort of quite difficult, because, you know, if you wanted to be a pop star, right, you know, and the political message was sort of secondary to that, and it kind of didn't fit too well with people who had like a strong social conscience. Mm. I don't know. I found myself caught between two camps, really, because I'm a musician first and foremost. You know, I have my political opinions, but I don't really like, I don't sort of say I particularly wanted to wear them on my sleeve, but I didn't have to, because I was in a band that played Doesn't Make It All Right, and I believed in that. I think I find I don't want to have to preach to people. I find that not exactly pretentious. That's not the word, but it's a bit condescending. Mm. You know, people have got their own minds to make up. If I can put something in front of them, then that's fine. But it's their decision. Mm. It's a difficult thing to talk about, really, for me anyway.
Mm. I often wonder about politically and socially conscious acts when they begin. There's that kind of righteous anger and justifiable righteous anger. But as the band becomes a business, if you like, more involved in the business, the music business, whether that is secondary, that the kind of fire in the belly becomes secondary, becomes...
I don't know. I must admit that I ain't doing this for the travel anymore.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But my heart still swells with pride when We Start Up Doesn't Make It All Right. I mean that song, and I meant it back in 1979, and I mean it now. And I'm still proud to be able to play Ghost Town and all those other tunes. So it isn't just entertainment. And I think the specials mean such an enormous amount to a lot of people out there. The people who come to our shows see it as a kind of celebration as well. Mm. I know there's a lot of nostalgia attached to that. But the people who come to see us are incredibly loyal and very, very partisan. Two Tone has been perhaps the cornerstone of their lives culturally. I still live in Coventry. I like to keep my feet on the ground. I wouldn't like to, you know, go around saying I influenced a generation, you know, because I think that's a pretentious, hideous thing to do. But the evidence is that the specials did, you know, and I'm very proud of that.
It doesn't mean that you're no good. Just because there's a reason, it doesn't mean it's understood. It doesn't make it alright. They're really clever to smash your head against the wall. Then they say you got it my way. They really think they know it all. It doesn't make it excuse in the world.
thinking about the fact that the band reformed, I've got this theory about bands that do this, the motivation behind it. Obviously, sometimes it's fiscal, but in most cases, I choose to believe that it isn't. You know, when the band is in its first flush, you're young and essentially free. When it begins, there's real joy there. The intervening years, there's probably kids, mortgages, responsibility, and so on. Then you hit a certain age and realise life is, in fact, finite. And that's quite a freeing thing, I think. Wilco Johnson and I had this conversation where he talked about his death sentence making him feel alive, more alive than he'd ever been. So in the case of putting a band back together, you've got to that point where you know there is going to be an end. So why not return to that state of joy, not in a nostalgic way, but actually claiming back some sort of unencumbered state of being? Does that make sense?
Well, you've kind of answered the question already, haven't you? I love doing this. I just feel very, very privileged to be in my sixth decade.
Yep.
And I feel like I'm 25 when you know, the lights go down and you go on stage and we start playing. It is a tremendous thing to be able to do that. And I'm just sort of like smugly go, oh, well, I'm just doing it because I'm just making a lot of money and I don't care. It would be false. I think it's a great thing that I do. But to get paid for it is wonderful as well. I don't know. It's a difficult thing. You know, it's not like I wouldn't do it if we didn't get paid. You know what I mean? But I don't think that's the I was a school teacher for 10 years before the band reformed. And it's like, and Linval called me and he says, well, do you want to be a rock star or do you want to shout at children? You know, and it's an easy decision, you know, really. I love it. I always tell people that being a school teacher was the second best job I ever had. But I'm my happiest when I'm playing these songs. You know, there's no one else who can play the bass to Special songs, you know, as well as I can, you know. And to be able to do that is an absolute privilege. I just feel very, very, very lucky. Does that really answer your question or does that sort of like circuit around it somehow?
I think it's somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But really, it was about...
Are we doing it just for a paycheck?
Are you doing it just for nostalgia, really? Or is it more about realising that this is something that defined you?
Definitely, yes. On my gravestone, it won't be, you know, Horace Panter, he was a pretty good art teacher. Or he was a pretty good white van man. You know, it'll be Horace Panter, he was the bass player in the Specials. I mean, that, you know, I wrote a book. While I was a school teacher, I thought I would retire as a school teacher. So I thought, well, I'll write these memoirs because there's no way I'm ever going to go back to doing that again. And I called it Scarred for Life because that's me. Because that is the defining period in my life is, you know, is I am that bloke what plays bass in the Specials. Fact, you know, end of.
Has there ever been a point where that's been a millstone for you, do you think? Because the title of the book is a great title, but it's...
It was kind of tongue in cheek. No, not really. I mean, I think because the Specials have that tremendous kudos, you know, and there are all these people all over the country who all, you know, wear Harringtons and Doc Martens and Ben Sherman shirts and Fred Perry's and stuff, and it's become their culture, and I'm part of that. I find that peculiar. When I try and get gigs for my blues band and I go on the bass player in the Specials, I go, so, you know, it doesn't matter. Can you play, you know, because that's a different thing. No, I've never found it an encumbrance, really. When I started painting again in 2009, it helped me, you know, the galleries didn't sort of put the phone down so quickly because I had this, you know, I've got this, you know, this reputation, if you like, in another creative field.
How long can the reformed Specials continue, do you think?
I have no idea. When we started, I was like I said, I was school teaching up until 2000, and I left Christmas 2008, and I thought we'd just take a year off, we'd do this, we'd have a great time, make a load of money, and then I'd go back to being a school teacher again. But it just carried on. So every year we think, well, how long can we do this? You know, and that was 7 years ago. But there are people out there who want to see us play. I always say that if we could only get like 1,500 quid for a gig on the back of a lorry in a pub car park outside Bedford, then I think that's the time when, you know, I think we need to call it a day. But people are prepared to see us, and not just in England. We've been all over the world. Mm. So since 2009. Next year we've got 2 weeks' work in Australia, followed by a week's work in Japan. We've been offered a show at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. Wow. in June and stuff like that. You know, we've just come back from 3 weeks in America. Mm. You know, before this tour started. So it's not just England where you know it's spread. Last year we went to South America for the first time. It was extraordinary. The show we did in Mexico City was like 1979. These people went wild for this stuff that was recorded, like, you know, 30, almost 40 years ago. Mm. It's extraordinary. Mm. It just shows that, you know, we obviously did something right back then, but just shows that the longevity and the integrity of the stuff, what we did. Mm. Yeah.
You mentioned your book, Scarred for Life. Mm. The sense that I got from reading that is that you are an incredibly hard worker. I was going to ask you what you do to relax, but I think
I play music to relax.
I was going to say, I think you actually work to relax. Yeah, yeah. As bizarre
yes,
as that might sound.
And I don't know. I find painting very therapeutic. I'm very that's not the word. Not the right word. It makes me sound that I'm in need of therapy. I find that very relaxing. The painting. I'm a bass player, so I need to to work collaboratively. I need to work with a drummer, you know, keyboard player, guitarist, vocalist, whatever. So I'm part of a team. But with the art, that's my solo album. So the work stands or falls by my efforts and my efforts only. That's kind of good. I appreciate that. But I'm always playing music. I've got a little blues band that works out of Coventry. We just play locally. I've got this thing called the Uptown Scar Collective, which is the guys from the Specials who aren't in the Specials. You know, the keyboard player, the Corn section, and various other bods from mainly Leicester. And we're great. We just do that traditional Scatterlights thing. And that's an awful lot of fun. And don't laugh, but I've just been working up a country and western band.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which it's just something that I just got into over the past couple of years. I worked with a Scottish guy called Champion Doug Veitch. Did a couple of shows with him, and it was like, gosh, this is like nothing I've ever played before. So I've started getting a little country and west. But that's just so once a week I'm playing something somewhere. Mm. If it's in a tiny little pub, you know, in Coventry or Warwickshire, or if it's in Mexico City or something, you know. But I love playing music, and I feel very privileged, you know, to be able to, you know, to still play it now. But even when I was a school teacher, I was playing on weekends.
Well, your art, there is some truly wonderful stuff there in the great pop art tradition. I'm personally very fond of the cassette drawing series. Mm. Is it difficult to combine that creative pursuit with the music?
Well, I just say I've got parallel careers. You know, people say, oh, what would you choose if you had to choose? Well, no, it would be totally impossible. I think for reasons that I've said, that one is a very sort of like a physical collaborative thing, and the other one is a very sort of solo, you know, quite contemplative thing. It's an enormous amount. I get a different kind of pleasure. If you like, the playing music, you get instant gratification or not. You know, if your people like you or they don't, and they usually voice that. So you know straight away whether you're hitting the right notes or it's working that evening. But with the painting, things take it takes like a couple of 3 weeks to get a painting together, and then it's like, well, has it worked or whatever? So it's a different kind of, there's more of like the enjoyment is more of a slow release with the art. Whereas, you know, with the music, it's like, bang, yeah, that worked. You know, like straight away. It's difficult, but it's impossible to choose between the two. but the thing is, the Specials aren't going to last forever. Mm. But I can still be in my 80s and paint. I hope. Mm. You know, we played a show in Japan a couple of 3 years ago. We did a festival, and also on the bill was blues guitarist Buddy Guy. The following night, he was going to be playing a little club in Tokyo to celebrate what would have been his 76th birthday. You know, and I took great comfort from that. You know, if he can do it, I mean, I think he's probably 80 by now. But if he can do it at that age, then that gives me an awful lot of comfort.
And the art obviously has never been a sideline for you. If anything, perhaps from reading your book, somewhere around the edges, I got the sense that the specials are perhaps a distraction from it, actually.
The specials were brilliant. I always wanted to be a pop star, and then I was when I was 25, and it was the greatest thing that happened to me in my life. But I always sort of had a thing about keeping your feet on the ground and having something to compare it to, so you didn't sort of become an idiot. So when the specials went to New York in 1980, everybody else went out to the nightclubs, but I went to bed early so I could go to the Guggenheim and the Museum of Modern Art the next day. And so I'd use the specials, the fact that I could tour the world and go and see some fantastic art in some of the world's greatest museums. I mean, it was just a... I wouldn't say that the art was more important, but they complemented one another.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's what I do. And you know, a few people say, when are you going to sort of slow down, Horace? And I have great difficulty in slowing down because there's always something to do.
Yeah.
You know, there's always something to do.
To round up then, what are you going to do next? What's next for you after this specials tour?
Oh, crikey. My garden is such a mess. I haven't looked at it for years. I've got to do that. No, I haven't got the faintest idea. There's some art to do. I've got, because the specials have been quite busy this year, there's a lot of sort of ideas for paintings stacking up. So I've got to do those. The cassette exhibition that recently we had in Los Angeles is appearing in London in February. So I've got a bit of work to do there to get that together. And the specials, I say, I've got a bit of work, or enough work, next year. So it'll be, there's a lot of painting to do. Yeah, I'm quite looking forward to it, really.
Excellent.
Yeah, good.
Horace Panter, thank you very much.
Steve, thank you very much. Pleasure.
www.themouthmagazine.com